But this yeah. is what mm. is the, I think, mm. the foundation mm. of this whole thing of the religion right. of art, mm. regarding the arts not as a sort of decoration,
right.
but as fundamental expression of the spirit. What would you say about that? You have a lot to say about it in your book.
Much, because yes. In the introductory essay, which is on the meaning of Buddhism and the value of art, I do make the point that the Buddha himself, in a sense, was a poet, which is not how people usually, in the Buddhist world at least, think of the Buddha. But the Buddha did speak, he did teach, and he often spoke and taught in verse, in poetry. Whether it was very good poetry is difficult to say. One needs, in any case, to read it in the original. Sometimes it is really quite good. And many of his disciples were poets. I don't know whether you're aware of this, but some of our friends are, that in the Buddhist scriptures, the Pali scriptures, there are two books which are collections of poems, songs, by the Buddha's male and female disciples. There's the Theragatha, the songs, the poems of the elder monks, and the Terigatha, the songs or poems of the elder nuns. Recently there was a poetry reading in Norwich in aid of our women's retreat centre, and I read there poems by women, and I included some English translations of the Terigatha, that is to say, poems written 2,500 years ago by some of these direct disciples, female disciples of the Buddha himself. And when I included these poems in the program, I thought that maybe, being so old and also being translated, they wouldn't come across quite so well as some of the actual poems by English women poets written in English recently. But actually they came across, so some of the women afterwards assured me, better than any of the other poems.
Yeah, probably better.
Yes, kind. Because they felt they were so real. At least one of them ended with the woman poet concerned with Terry gaining enlightenment. Huh? The poem culminated in that. The end of the poem was the end of her spiritual quest.
That is poetry being used as a way of after all, poetry isn't whether a thing is in verse or not, is it? It's the language of the soul.
Yes.
I would define poetry as the language, the natural language of the soul. Which tends to be rhythmic, because the higher one goes in the level of consciousness, the more rhythmic it becomes. And of course, prophetic supreme poetry is the language of the spirit. Our present society doesn't make any distinction. There is only one level, that is the daily level. And if you deny the level of the soul, you are in fact denying poetry.
Yes.
And you cannot call poetry, even if it is in splendid verse, what relates only to the mundane lower levels of consciousness.
Yes.
It is as you go higher, so it becomes more fully poetic, would you not say?
Yes, indeed. In traditional Indian literary criticism, which is neither Buddhist nor Hindu by Jain, but which is, as it were, a common tradition, there is a term, kavita, which we usually translate as poetry, but the Indian critics, the traditional critics, make it clear that kavita is neither verse nor prose. It can be expressed, or it can find expression in terms of verse, but it can equally find expression in terms of prose.
It's where it comes from.
It's where it comes from. It's the level from which
the
it
level.
Comes.
The level. Could you please... Speak a little about that, Sangharakshita, because you in your first essay in that book have very interesting things to say about the Indian view of different levels from which poetry comes, and you quote Sri Aurobindo, whom I also have read that book and very much agreed with what you were saying, so could you perhaps say a little about that?
Well, in all the Indian spiritual traditions, and even in Western traditions until recently, it was generally recognized that there were many different levels of consciousness accessible to the individual human being, some lower, some higher. And Aurobindo has elaborated on this in a quite interesting way. He speaks in terms of the vital on the lower mental and the higher mental and the overmind. And he speaks of this mainly, he speaks of these different levels mainly in connection with the experience of yoga. In Buddhism also we have these different levels. We have, for instance, the levels of the four jhanas, the levels of higher consciousness. There's a set of four lower higher levels and a set of four higher levels, and so on. There are other classifications too. But this is common ground to all the great spiritual traditions, especially in the East. But Aurobindo very interestingly speaks of a poetic inspiration, artistic inspiration, as coming from any of these, from the vital, from the lower mental, the higher mental. And he seems to believe that the higher the level, the greater the poetry. But of course, with this proviso, which I'm not sure that he actually makes, that it is poetry to begin with. Because I think I know what you're thinking. The Aurobindo's theory is excellent, but his actual practice as a poet doesn't necessarily quite come up to his own artistic standards.
He wasn't a kabi. Yeah. But in India, don't you find, I've read poetry in India quite a number of times now, I always find that the Indian audience is it's sort of antennae, saying what level is it coming from. They don't hear the sort of thing is to notice how it is structured, how well made the poem is, or if it's realistic, or if it relates to social realities, or if it's Marxist, or whatever, you see. Not so in India. There is always this double listening taking place.
Right.
There's this the sensual ear, and there's also the other ear. Yeah.
It's a piping to the spirit, bitters of no tone.
Precisely, yes. One is very aware of that. And many excellent, I mean, poets that in England pass for, you know, the sort of thing that people go for, doesn't get anywhere in India. Because they're listening from where does it come from?
Because one must recollect that even now in India, so many people are illiterate. I mean, I'm very aware of this because when I go to India, when I give lectures, I know that 3/4 of my audience is illiterate. And therefore, the oral medium is very important. It's the main source of education for a lot of people. And this perhaps helps to explain why in India they do have so many of these, what one can only call, poetry meets. They're not poetry readings in our Western, or at least our English sense. You get vast crowds of people just assembled to hear poets read their own poems. This is especially so in the traditional Urdu poetry. And you might have 10,000, 20,000 people under some vast shamiana, and you get the poet standing up, and he usually knows his own poem by heart. He doesn't read it. He pronounces it. He evokes it. And a wave of emotion just passes over the whole vast audience. It's
but
a very special
thing. Trouble with India is it's so westernized. You get so many Indian poets who are writing in a sort of secular way.
Yes.
But, of course, I have also heard readings of the... In Hindi, of the Mahabharata and of the Ramayana, and people assemble to hear these. These are the traditional source, both of poetry and teaching.
Indeed,
both teaching and lifting the story onto the level of the, not to the sensual ear, but to the spirit.
Yes.
And this keeps the whole consciousness, or did, because it's all becoming very secularized, but it kept the consciousness of the whole people attuned to things of the spirit. I don't know what corresponds to that in Buddhism, the reciting of...
Well, in all Buddhist countries, there are different ways of reciting Jataka stories, that is to say, the legendary stories of the Buddha's previous lives. And you get it done in all sorts of ways. Sometimes it's dramatized, and sometimes you get two monks sitting on either side of the altar, and they do a sort of double act, you know, recreating the whole story and playing on the feelings of the audience. This is very common in Thailand, I believe, very popular.
Yes.
But a more recent development in Indian Buddhism, which is very interesting, I don't know if you've heard of it, is what is called Dalit literature. Dalit means depressed. Not depressed in the psychological sense, but in the sociological sense. The depressed classes are the untouchables, many of whom have become Buddhists. And there's a whole movement of Dalit literature which has sprung up quite spontaneously from among these Dalit people, mainly in and around Bombay and Pune, giving expression to their deepest feelings as not only untouchables and depressed people, but as Buddhists. You get the two things working together. And there's a whole very live literary movement.
Literacy has nothing to do whatsoever with spirituality. Literacy in our country is a sort of terrible deception. It enables people to read advertisements for aftershave lotion and all the rubbish comes through literacy.
Well, Kumaraswamy wrote a famous essay, didn't he, on the bugbear of literacy.
Bugbear of literacy. Yes. Precisely.
The bugbear of numeracy.
Illiterate people, and I used to know them a bit in the Hebrides, now they're all literate, of course, but they too have an oral tradition which preserves the, as it were, qualities of the soul of that particular people. I'm afraid I'm not very interested in readings of modern poetry. It all seems to me to belong to the secular decline of our civilization, and I feel that the loss of oral tradition. My mother came from Scotland, not the Highlands, but she had a wealth of oral poetry, the border ballads, the songs of Burns, which of course were traditional songs gathered. All this embodied and preserved, and you get it in Ireland to this day, the wealth of that whole culture is within it. And modern poetry is highly individualistic. It's self-expression, it's mostly on the level of the external world. And Yeats, of course, was a great exception. There are great poets who rise above this. But